From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Elementary school parents are outraged about Boston Public Schools pushing start times at some schools to 7:15 a.m.
I feel very much that the district reached out to all of us and asked us what we wanted for our children, and then went ahead and did the opposite.
Plus, how far along are Boston's autonomous vehicle companies?
Each day we're showing more and more sophistication on the road. And I think what you'll see in the coming year to 2 years is some deployments of this technology in the context of a commercial product.
Also today, the cars.
We ventured to Boston in 1972, arrived in Harvard Square, and heard the Modern Lovers playing on the Common.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, this is the place for me.
He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now. Rick Ocasek, coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Boston Public Schools are making changes to start times next fall. 105 of the city's 125 schools will have new bell times. Most of the high schools will start after 8 a.m., but some K-8 schools will start at 7:15 in the morning. Here's Superintendent Tommy Chang last night at what turned out to be a contentious public meeting.
Our goal here was to make the most equitable decisions for the entire school system. We knew we needed to move start times for high school students later and move elementary school departure times earlier.
Now, most of the high school families are really happy about this, but it's many elementary school parents who are outraged by the changes. Some families' schedules could be shifted by more than 2 hours. At the Boston School Committee meeting last night, parents begged officials not to adopt the new start times. Here's one parent during the public comment period who said that the new times could be ruinous for children, parents, and the district as a whole.
And equally as important, I'm here to stand with the parents who aren't here right now. Single dad who's working two jobs who will not be able to afford after school or before school. This policy is going to get families to leave the system and to leave the city.
That's right.
Now, we asked Superintendent Tommy Chang and BPS Chief of Operations John Hanlon to join us. They declined our request for a conversation today. So joining us is Jessica Tang, president of the Boston Teachers Union. Jessica, it's good to have you back.
Hi, how are you? Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us today. Also with us is Johanna Haney, a parent of a first grader at Manning Elementary School. She's also written an article for WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas page. It's called Changing School Start Times Has Ripple Effects. And those ripples could sink many families. Johanna, welcome to you.
It's a privilege to be here.
Johanna, let me just start with you. Oh, by the way, let me let folks know. I'm going to guess that a lot of you out there listening right now, this may have an impact on you. So send me a tweet at Radio Boston if you want to, and let me know what you make of the changes of the school start and release times. Or you can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Okay, Johanna, first of all, to you, how is the Manning going to change, and how could that have an impact on your child and your family?
So Manning Elementary currently starts at 9:30 in the morning, and we go till 4:10, and we're slated to change to start at 7:15 and end at 1:55. At the school committee meeting last night, Superintendent Chang indicated this was going to be an adjustment for our families. This isn't an adjustment for my family. It's an emergency. Mm. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I don't want my daughter to be in school for up to 11 hours, which would be the case if she goes to after school care. So then, you know, I'm left wondering if I should, you know, forego my career aspirations so that I can be there at 2 o'clock every afternoon. It's really difficult for me to make a decision by the time the BPS lottery opens in early January, because we have no idea what the after school care is going to look like, how much it's going to cost. We have no information to even make this decision.
So let me ask you about that, because Boston Public Schools have said that they're trying to be sure that every family has access to a variety of different schools that may have up to 10 different start times. So couldn't you find one that might fit the needs of your family?
That's a wonderful idea in theory. It's extraordinarily difficult to change schools when you're not entering at, you know, one of the K levels, K0, K1, K2. I called the BPS Welcome Center, I think on Friday, the day after the announcement, to ask about my options. She literally laughed at me.
Laughed?
She laughed at me.
Why?
I was inquiring what schools I may be eligible for. Sort of what the process is for, you know, a second grader. My daughter's in first grade now, so she'll be in second grade. What are her odds of getting a spot? And she laughed.
Okay.
And I think the sentiment among a lot of parents is that we don't have a lot of hope that we can actually even change schools in a way that's going to work better for our families.
Now, I want to repeat that we did put out a request, an interview request, to both Superintendent Tommy Chang and BPS Chief of Operations John Hanlon. They declined to join us, which is unfortunate because all the important questions right now I wish I could ask of BPS. So, Superintendent Chang, if you happen to be listening right now, 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call, and I'd love to hear from you. But Jessica Tang, President of the Boston Teachers Union, this is an interesting challenge for teachers, right? Because on the one hand, the high school start time, pushing that later, people seem to be happy about that. That works for high school students. But, you know, how does the BTU look at the concerns that seems as if many elementary families have about, you know, maybe having to get their kids up at 5:30 in the morning to catch a 6:30 bus for a 7:15 start time?
So, to be clear, we did not have any say in the final, configurations and times and changes. And we are concerned, too. We had actually, as part of the stakeholder group, which, again, had no authority and final decision-making power, had advocated that no school actually start before 7:45 a.m. because we know about the challenges. And for teachers, actually, it's really hard when you have your own children, and teachers are parents as well. Where do you bring your children before 6:30 a.m. to get to school on time for your own job, right? And really, it's before 6:30 a.m. It's really 6 a.m. And so teachers are concerned. It has been really unfortunate because we did have a general agreement that the 9:30 start time, especially for the extended learning time that was rolled out this year in so many of our schools, was not working. And so we did feel that earlier start times in general would help to maximize learning time, but we were surprised as well at the 7:15 and had actually actively advocated against that.
Hmm. Well, let's take a quick call here. Rachel is calling from her elementary school pickup right now. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi, I am actually picking my child up from the JFK school in Jamaica Plain right now. It is an elementary school, and our pickup time is currently 3:10, which works great for our community. And I wanted to say that 80% of our school is in poverty. We have a high Latino population. And the sorts of issues that are going to come up as a result of this are things people are not talking about, such as a lot of children receive their food at school. And if we finish school at 1:15 or 1:55, there's a large population of children that will be very hungry later in the day.
Well, Rachel, can I just jump in here for a second? Because as you know, last night and also in its documentation, BPS and Superintendent Chang have said that they're committed to working with parents, families, and schools to provide extended before and after school care for families who may be suffering an impact from these schedule changes. Does that give you, I mean, you brought up the issue of a good point of food, but does that give you any relief from your concern?
You know, no, because that is something that BPS is currently not providing for children. So there are wait lists at many schools, and it is also a cost factor for many parents to provide that, and they can't get in. So it's also not something they're currently not meeting that need. So I don't see any reason to think that they're going to be able to meet a greater increased need.
Mm. Rachel, thank you so much for your call. Johanna, when Rachel made that point about lots of children getting food and additional important care from schools, you raised your hands up as if to say yes.
Yes, yes. That's a huge issue that really is not being talked about nearly enough. At my daughter's school, kids come in and they eat breakfast at school around 9 o'clock. A lot of the students in the BPS community rely on this. So with a 7:15 start time, let's assume they can eat breakfast. I'll assume that they'll figure out how to do that. But then lunch is going to have to be 11, 10:30. And that may be a child's last square meal of the day.
Jessica Tang, let me ask you about this question of I gave to the caller, Rachel, that Superintendent Chang has said whatever cost savings they may engender or beyond that, whatever is needed to help expand coverage during the day for some students, that they're committed to doing that. I mean, is that something that gives the concerns that the BTU may have put those concerns at ease?
I do think we have to think about how to best support the schools that have really gotten the short end of the stick here because, you know, to be fair, some of the schools are benefiting from the school start times, but there are incredible number of schools at the 7:15 and also that had changed over an hour and a half or 2 hours that do need help. There's got to be a plan for before school and after school programming, and I do think that is part of the solution, but at the same time, I also do think we need to think about what is the priority here and how to make sure we're not pitting schools against each other and making sure that all students have access to times that maximize their learning.
Right. I mean, because I heard some parents last night say that they're just concerned that this is sort of trading one problem for another, that there was this challenge with high school students starting too early, so them not getting sort of the best use of their time and their day, given the circadian rhythms of high school students. So maybe we've solved that problem, but we've created a whole new set of problems for elementary students. Right. But on top of that, Jessica, from what I understand, as I read the data provided by BPS, there, one positive thing that BPS says is that there's maybe greater equity amongst start times now across the elementary schools because more of the schools that have a higher percentage of white students have been nudged towards earlier start times. I mean, what's your reaction to that?
Again, I think equity is an important issue, but the equity issue is not just about, well, now we've more evenly distributed the bad times across demographics. I think equity means how do we, again, make sure that all students have access to a time that works for their family.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, I just wanted to jump in here because we're fast running down on time here. But someone who calls themselves Entrenched sent us a tweet saying, can someone explain why changing high school start times affects elementary school start times when high school students in Boston use the MBTA? Well, we actually did talk to BPS today about exactly that question. And a BPS spokesperson told us that roughly 25% of high school students need of some sort of busing through BPS. And so therefore, that has some kind of knock-on effect across the whole district. And BPS has said you can't really change some start times without having an effect across the district as a whole. You know, but on the other hand, Dan O'Brien, BPS's press secretary, couldn't answer my question when I asked him how much would the district save. The idea, he said, is that maybe with these different start and end times, the district might use fewer buses. But he said, as for the savings, I don't have an exact dollar amount right now. So when BPS has one, we'll definitely put it on the air. But Johanna, go ahead.
Yeah, if I could jump in and say, you know, I would wonder how much of that savings would be wiped away by some of these really long after school programs. I mean, my daughter's school, she would be there for, you know, 4 hours after school program in the building, 11 hours a day. So if they are, you know, if they're going to need to subsidize that for families, doesn't it all come out in the wash? Why can't we just invest in our kids and getting them, you know, a reasonable night's sleep?
Yeah. Well, Liz Sherva sent me a tweet saying our change would put my son in school from 7:15 to 1:15. He would have to go to after school programs till 4:30, gone from home for over 10 hours. Most daycares won't let you leave kids for that long. Let's take another call here. Malika is calling from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, Malika.
Hi, I'm not from Jamaica Plain, I'm from Dorchester. But I just wanted to say our children with special needs, I have a child that has the emotional impairment. And when we think about starting the school time earlier, we're not taking into consideration that there's a certain consistency that parents already have to work with getting our kids to school. And when we talk about after schools and before school programs, there aren't many that we can afford that can even support our children correctly. So this is a really big problem.
Malika, thank you so much for your call, and I apologize for getting your location incorrect. Forgive me for that. Jessica Tang, I mean, do you think this is we're in a workable place right now, or can there be, has the district since last night responded with any willingness to sort of take on board parental and some of the concerns that the BTU has put forth?
I hope so. It seemed to me that at least for the school committee members, there was a willingness to look back at what's happened. And we had, again, advocated about that for that from the start, to say that you've got to have a window of period to have human feedback, because there are just some things that algorithms can't take into consideration. So if there's any way possible to fix this, we are certainly interested in working with the school department to figure out best solutions and make sure we're incorporating the feedback from our parents, students, and families who are most greatly impacted by the changes.
Right. So you mentioned algorithms, and I just wanted to let you know that we spoke today, in preparing for today's conversation, we spoke with Dimitris Bertimas, and he's with he's the co-director of MIT's Operations Research Center, and he actually worked with Boston Public Schools to formulate these algorithms that could route buses and determine start times, et cetera. And he said the research was directed to allow later high school start times, look for fairness and decrease costs. And he says that he thinks that they were successful in that part, and that in terms of the cost savings, he's not sure yet by how much, but that the savings will be substantial. I just want to play one more piece of tape here before we wrap up, because I do want to note we've been focusing on elementary school, but not everyone is opposed to the summation of the changes, because, again, the high schoolers are starting later. And Deb Putnam, a parent of a Boston Latin Academy student, she's also the Boston chapter leader of Start School Later, Inc., she says she's thrilled with the changes.
I've talked to hundreds of parents, and, you know, some of them are not in favor of this, but most of them are by all means. So we're very excited about it. I think it's a bold step for Boston. I think they have a lot of work to do.
Johanna Haney, you get the last word here in the last couple seconds we have. I know you don't feel the same way, so what would you like BPS to do now?
Someone at the school committee meeting last night said, and I wish I could attribute this to the right person, that BPS can't save from their budgets on the backpacks of our kindergartners. That's what I want the Boston Public Schools and Superintendent Chang to understand. We will leave the district. Families will leave, and that's going to have a severe impact on budgets too. So
that's why you're calling it an emergency?
Yep.
Well, Johanna Haney is a Boston Public Schools parent. Thank you so much for joining us, Johanna.
Thank you.
And Jessica Tang, president of the Boston Teachers Union, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
And I just want to remind everyone, we did put out an interview request to Superintendent Tommy Chang and Director of Operations John Hanlon. BPS declined our request for an interview. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Select passengers can now hail a self-driving car in the seaport. That's where local startup Newtonomy is now testing their fleet of autonomous vehicles in partnership with the ride-hailing company Lyft. And just on Tuesday, the company said they're launching a new technology center in Boston as well, along with the global autonomous vehicle company Aptiv. President of Newtonomy, Carl Yanyema, says the new center will focus on developing the vehicle's brain and perception capabilities.
Really what this dictates is expertise in machine learning, expertise in data mining, expertise in some very specialized robotic technology. These are really the component parts from a technical perspective of a self-driving car.
Well, joining us now to bring us up to date on all the developments surrounding autonomous vehicles is Bostonomics reporter Zeninjor Enwemeka. Hi there, Zeninjor.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so let's first of all start off with Newtonomy's autonomous vehicle pilot program that they had in the seaport, right? Were those cars on the streets with passengers?
Yes, they were. So Newtonomy did a two-week trial last month where they had a select group of volunteers. These were sort of friends and family of the company, but they basically rode in self-driving cars. And these trips looped around the Seaport District. So they started at the company's office on Dry Dock Avenue, then went along Summer Street and Congress Street.
Dying to get in one myself. But what were passengers' reactions?
So according to Newtonomy, passengers generally felt safe in the autonomous vehicles. Some even thought the cars were a little bit too cautious.
That sounds very Boston.
It sounds very Boston. But, you know, Newtonomy says that this type of feedback is really critical in understanding how autonomous vehicles could potentially be used in the future.
Okay. And there was a ride-hailing portion to this test as well.
Yeah, that's right. So Nutonomy has partnered with Lyft for the next phase of this passenger pilot program. So that is underway right now. So there is a select group of people who can use the Lyft app to hail a Nutonomy self-driving car in the Seaport District.
Still waiting for Lyft to make me one of those select folks.
Me too. You and me both.
So will these also be... So they're still pre-selected people.
Yes,
then.
They are.
I guess that's going to answer my next question, which is, could I go find one next week? No. So let's move on. Can you tell us more about the technology center that Nutonomy wants to open?
Yeah. So this week, Nutonomy and its new parent company, Aptiv, which is a global autonomous vehicle company, announced that they're going to open a facility in the Seaport District to develop technology for self-driving cars. So here's Carl Yanyema, the president of Nutonomy.
It'll be an office with a heavy focus on technology development. So there'll be lab environments in the office. It'll be mostly stocked with engineers and scientists. And so that's the place where we'll be developing the core technology and software that's going to go into the next generation vehicle.
And Carl says that a commercial product could be available for average riders in the next 1 to 2 years. And the company is actually already much further along in Singapore right now, and they plan to launch a commercial service there next year.
Wow. Okay. So, but closer to home, I understand that Boston isn't the only place where pilot programs are going on. There's going to be another one.
Yes, that's
coming
right.
Up? Okay.
Yes. So, Optimus Ride, which is another Boston-based ride-hailing company, they are planning to roll out their own autonomous vehicle pilot program with passengers. So this is going to take place about 12 miles south of the city in South Weymouth at a new mixed-use development called Union Point. So what's different here is Optimus Ride is partnering with this real estate developer, L-Star Ventures. So residents of Union Point can use an app to hail a ride within that community as well as to connect to the commuter rail station there.
Okay, great. And you have some tape from someone from L-Star?
Yeah. So Matthew Berry of L-Star Ventures says that Union Point is really sort of a lab for them to test this technology.
We can learn and test and have opportunities to, you know, change and evolve. And then as soon as we really understand and with our partners understand, like Optimus Ride, how best to implement a program, we'd be happy to share that with other communities. And so we do think it is a rare opportunity.
Some more evidence on how self-driving vehicles are going to change how we live. I think we're seeing
definitely.
Those pilot programs. Bostonomics reporters Anindya and Womeka, thank you as always.
Happy to do it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced its newest inductees. They are Nina Simone, the Moody Blues, Dire Straits, Bon Jovi, and the Cars. A couple of years ago, we spoke with Cars frontman Rick Ocasek. He's pretty much rock royalty here in Boston, and he's one of the most unassuming people I have ever interviewed. Really. And here's why. Throughout our interview, I'd been pronouncing his name Rick Ocasek. And when we wrapped up, I asked him to say his name and title just so we were sure to have that on tape. It's pretty much standard operating procedure at the end of recorded interviews. Now, remember, I'd been pronouncing his name Rick Ocasek during the conversation. So just listen to what he said.
Hi, this is Rick Ocasek, and I'm from the Cars.
Okay, first and foremost, I have to say you're such a gentleman because you didn't tell me that I've been pronouncing your last name wrong.
Oh, no, it's okay.
No, it's not okay. I'm so sorry.
No, people pronounce it a lot of different ways, and I don't care less how they pronounce it. And, you know, it's subjective as well because I have relatives who go, Otkasek, Otkasek. There's a lot of different ways I guess people could say it. It is a weird spelling.
Well, you've been so cool
about
it. It's
not really wrong or right. I mean, I think my family says Ocasek, so that's the way I say it.
I'm going to go back and reintroduce you and get it right now. But Rick Ocasek, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
Well, when we talked with Rick Ocasek back in 2013, he had just released a new book called Lyrics and Prose. And I started by asking him to walk us down memory lane. Let's go! I'd love to hear from you. Why is it that you did, what, back in 1972, decide to come to Boston?
Ben and I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time. We had a band called Leatherwood. And oddly enough, we used to open for Iggy Pop and the MC5. And we had to kind of abandon, kind of wreck your equipment. Thinks thought we were, you know, pretty kind of hard stuff. But anyway, when it was time to get rid of or move, we sort of ran out of money and pawned over our equipment. And all I had left was an acoustic. And I thought that I knew that Cambridge was a good place to come with an acoustic guitar because I'd heard that you can play at Club 47 and you could play at, you know, Passiums and all those places if you had an acoustic guitar. So we ventured to Boston in 1972, or probably 71 or 2. Arrived in Harvard Square and heard the Modern Lovers playing on the Common.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, this is the place for me. The Modern Lovers are here. It's unbelievable. So we just kind of played on our own for a while. Just Ben and I, acoustically.
Yeah.
And we managed to just scrape by while we were there, but we loved the city, so
well,
that's how we got there.
There's a story, which I'm dying to know if it's true or not, but I've read that in 74, you and Ben Orr were playing as a duo at a Boston Ground Round restaurant on the South Shore, and you guys were playing until a vice president or a manager stopped you one night, or actually he stopped in one night of the company, and he said you couldn't play anymore because you weren't family friendly entertainment. Is that true?
Yeah, it is.
What were you singing?
It is true.
What were you singing?
I don't know. We were just we were always playing, even when we played those places in Boston in the beginning. We told people that we played top 40 stuff so we could get the gig. But then when we went there, we never played any of that. We just played my own songs. Some people thought they were top 40 and they just missed it. So that was probably the reason. We kind of got fired from a bunch of places.
That's amazing to me that you guys ever played at a Ground Round. But
We played the Ground Round quite a few times because the Ground Round actually paid. Because they could actually pay for it. So, you know.
Not bad, actually.
So we played the Ground Round. It was a weird place to play.
And obviously the rest is history because the Cars go on to be this super group of the 80s. Talking about the story behind a song on, of course, the Cars' debut album, maybe one of your most beloved songs, and that is My Best Friend's Girl.
Always dancing down the street with the sway blue eyes. That you meet, it doesn't know the real surprise.
And I wanted to ask you about it because I'm looking in the new book, Lyrics and Prose, and there it is on page 5, the printed text of My Best Friend's Girl. But on the facing page, there's a photograph of what I gather to be, what is that, the original manuscript of the song?
Oh, yeah, quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah. It looks like the original song title was Best Friend's Girl. And someone hand wrote the word in my in front of that.
Yeah, that's true. It must have been me.
So the
I guess that my had to be there.
But it wasn't there to begin with?
Oh, I think maybe when I was, you know, once you start singing the song and all that stuff, maybe I was throwing in a my, so I thought I better put the my in there.
She's my best friend's girl. She used to be my
Well, why don't you tell me the story of the process or the background or what inspired the song?
Well, that's a good question. I could never remember that. That's like 100 years ago. But, songs, when I write songs, I usually write a lot at a time. I could write anywhere from 20 to 30 songs at a time. All the songs are kind of a little autobiographical, although I never, I don't know that any songs I've ever written have been situations that I thought I needed to document because they were sort of historical in my mind or an historical moment.
Mm-hmm.
Although, maybe so, if I leap through, maybe so.
Let the good times roll. Let them knock you around. Let the good times roll. Let them make you a clown.
So the book, it's not just lyrics, it's called Lyrics and Prose. Do you have the book there in front of you or with you?
I kind of do. Somebody could just handed it to me.
Okay, great. Because we're talking about sort of prose. Mm-hmm. I'd love it if you could read one of the prose pieces in the book called Paul's Bakery.
I'm sitting here at Paul's Bakery watching the blizzard and waiting for the studio to open. Everyone's late when the New England snow blows. I'll probably work on the same song for the rest of my life. All songs being one. Hume said that the entire world is in one's mind. All knowledge comes from sensory impression rather than a prior aspect of reality. You don't see time, for instance. So what's the rush? Time is close. Things get quiet when it snows. Time seems to stand still, like when your mind sleeps between thoughts. So let's talk about envy and jealousy and girlfriends and music, misunderstanding, art, money, trips, death, and slime balls. Muscles, cheap talk, friends, videos, leather, business, skin, purpose, rain and bombs, lawyers, notes and sounds, rhythm, drugs, booze, fights, life. Environments, pleasure, rumors, images, pressure, guns, style, escape, movement, junkies, losers, motivation, jobs, and God, and smoke, and differences, and eyes, and the future, and illusions, and waste traps, and focus, and feeling, and time. It's still snowing outside Paul's Bakery, but I could suck in the smell of this place for a trillion picoseconds. Everyone's late when the New England snow blows.
Hmm. So that's Rick Ocasek reading his work, Paul's Bakery, from, it appears in the new book, which is kind of more an anthology called Lyrics and Prose. I've heard that you really don't consider yourself to be kind of a front and center entertainer. That rather,
right.
Like that you're, that's not who you are. So how would you describe what you consider yourself to be?
Tall.
I should have expected that. Tall, handsome, dark haired.
Oh, I don't know about the handsome. I don't get any awards for that. But anyway, I consider myself a writer, a songwriter for sure. It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. I started writing songs, I think. I attempted to write a song when I was 14. I never got to. Once I decided to play music, I immediately thought, well, I don't care if I can play the instrument. I just want to write songs. I've never considered myself a musician, although I can play a lot of things. I'm not a school musician, nor can I read music, but I always wanted to write whole songs and be a songwriter, and I always knew that no matter what band I was ever in, it was going to be a band that played the songs I wrote. And of course, in the early days, you know, they weren't very good songs, but I put a lot of bands through a lot of crap to make them play them until finally, you know, years and years after having a half a dozen bands, finally the songs got good enough.
you ended up being essentially the front man for one of the biggest rock groups of a generation.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how that happened.
Well, Rick Ocasek, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Rick Ocasek, he's the front man for The Cars. The band was just named one of the newest inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We spoke with him back in 2013. This week, we've been ending the show with excerpts from Modern Love, the podcast. It's from the folks here at WBUR and our colleagues at the New York Times. I'm lucky enough to host the podcast. Today's excerpt is a particularly timely and important one, especially in the current moment we all find ourselves in. Me too. Now, those two words have created a flood of emotion over the past months, with millions of women and men using social media to acknowledge sexual abuse or harassment they've personally experienced. So this excerpt of Modern Love, the podcast, comes to us from graduate student Heather Burtman. It's read by Cleopatra Coleman. She reads Heather Burtman's essay, My Body Doesn't Belong to You.
When the stranger yelled at me from his car window, I was carrying my Zamiococcus zamiifolia, a large tropical plant I had just bought at a greenhouse. I couldn't hear what he said, but I don't think he was complimenting my plant. His words, whatever they were, brought to mind all of the derogatory comments and crude propositions I had heard before. From different car windows and different men, all of the comments about my body and suggestions for what I could do with it. It was as if once I turned 16, my body no longer belonged to me, but to the world at large, and to certain men who drove their cars past it. When I was a little girl, playing shirtless in my family's garden, my body felt as if it belonged only to me. We had a rectangle-shaped yard out of which we would dig a smaller rectangle, and this dark patch of soil would become our garden. At 5, 6, and 7 years old, my siblings and I laughed as we shook out fat chunks of grass and produced a shower of dirt that went up our noses and down our chests. I liked the way the dirt felt, all freshly dug against my skin, and I asked my mother to bury me in it the way she sometimes did at the beach. She buried me halfway, and I smiled and posed for a picture. I liked being that way. A bare, muddy torso with a handful of seeds that I thought might grow carrots and yield a future in which my body was my body. And your body was your body. During my senior year of high school, I went in for my second bra fitting at JCPenney, where the fitter sniffed a little in disapproval when telling me my cup size, as if she were thinking, "How dare you grow those?" I was now the keeper of this secret. There are sizes beyond double D. You can be an H, for example. That is British sizing. Or a K. That is American sizing. The British make better bras. I was the girl with the big breasts. There were jokes, compliments from female friends, promises that my future boyfriend or husband or lover would have plenty to be happy about. There were men who stared. Men who asked, "Are those real?" I had no answer. I didn't remember consciously deciding about their size or doing anything about it. Around then, I realized that in this world, there would be many instances when my body would not feel like my body. When I was in a club and a man grabbed my butt and then my hands, trying to pull me in to dance, you can say no 100 times, and he will still pull. There is the knot of your hands and his, and the harder you pull away, the harder he pulls closer. It is like a game to him, like one of those colorful woven tubes that trap your fingers when you exert opposing forces. If you are lucky, your friends will yell at him until he lets go. You will stand there stunned, suddenly realizing how sticky the dance floor is. Also wondering if they have a nice-smelling hand soap in the bathroom. Hand soap that smells like summer air. Being young. Outside. But that is the smell of another world entirely. One that no longer seems to exist. When I walk to work, and men smile at me along the way, they don't have nice smiles anymore. "What's your name?" they say. "Come on, sweetheart, tell me your name." They follow me. Their footsteps like trees falling. I can feel it in the air. Their need to take something from me. It has nothing to do with me in particular, with me as an individual. It has nothing to do with how I was once a fearless, naked gardener with a blue plastic teapot and a collection of puzzles. If I were to tell them my name, would they remember it? Would they invite me out to a nice dinner and listen as I told them stories about my childhood? Would this be true love? I can picture the scene now. I'm at brunch with my girlfriends at a place that serves bottomless Bloody Marys and slightly overcooked eggs. After round 3, we find ourselves on the usual subject, how we met our significant others. My girlfriends lean in a little closer and say, "Oh, Heather, please tell the story again. Tell us how you and Lyle met." "Well," I begin, taking one last sip of Bloody Mary, "I was walking down the street when Lyle drove by and yelled, 'Hey, baby,' and asked me to have sex with him. And I thought, this one's a keeper." Such behavior is not about me. It's not about love. It's not even about sex. It is about fear and power. What certain men gain from feeding on such things, I do not know. And I do not want to know. While traveling in France one year, I held onto my friend's arm as a man followed us for maybe 1/2 mile, yelling something I didn't understand. There was the glittering river, the stone bridge, the creperie closed for the night. Only the fear really existed. "We can take him," I whispered to her. "I mean, if anything happens." We marched forward, eyeing the distance between the hunted and the hunter. I was too scared to think, and uncertain of how one even got a hold of the police out there. In Connecticut one day, a man drove past me only to turn around and come back. "Oh my God," I thought. "He came back." I felt the fear descending upon me the way a colorful parachute does in a childhood game of cat and mouse. He talked. He laughed. He watched me try not to blink. I always blinked. What is the verb? To savor. To luxuriate in torturing another. Sadism. If someone does this to you, do not give in to the temptation to smile. I tell myself to be the strong woman my mother taught me to be and not smile, but I almost always do. One man said to me, "Do you know who I am? I'm Don Juan, and I'm the best lover in the world. See for yourself." And I thought, good for you, sir, good for you. I smiled at him, laughed even. Another man on another day stood on the sidewalk in front of me as dusk was falling. He was with his friends, and he reached out his arms and pulled me toward him. And what did I do? "I've got to go," I said. "I've got to go," sweet smile. "Walk, don't run. They smell fear, they chase." I will never be 6 again. I no longer remember what it is like to bask shirtless with a garden against my skin, or for someone to take a picture of my naked torso that they will actually develop at Walgreens. I am 24, and my body makes life dangerous for me. My breasts, my hips, the way I walk. Any woman's breasts, any woman's hips, the way any woman walks. It's all somehow too tempting. Our full lips or thin lips, our necks exposed beneath cropped hair, or our long hair, or the split ends we pick at while sitting on the bus, our pierced or unpierced ears, the infinite circle of belly button winking beneath our shirts. We look too good in our t-shirts and jeans. We look too good bundled up in our coats, carrying houseplants down the street. When we walk home to our apartments late at night, we carry our keys spread out between our fingers and we jump at the shadows of shadows. In the daylight, we pretend we were never afraid. A couple of years ago, in the warmth of summer, I stood naked on a dock, and my body was my body. My two girlfriends were standing naked beside me, and their bodies were their bodies. Our breasts were our breasts. Our clothes were our clothes that we had chosen to wear and chosen to take off, leaving them in warm heaps on the chilled wood next to the damp footprints which were also ours. When we jumped into the water, we chose to jump in. The weeds brushed against our bodies obliviously, encircling our fingers and toes and hips with no knowledge of or care about which was which. We splashed water with our fists and yelled, but if we were afraid, it was only a fish. That thought made us laugh. We saluted the dark, starry, silent sky, and it did not so much as whistle back.
Cleopatra Coleman, reading Heather Burtman's modern love essay, My Body Doesn't Belong to You. Now, as part of Modern Love, the podcast, we often ask actors why they picked certain essays to read for us. And Coleman said that Burtman's essay brought up a lot of memories for her.
It articulates something that I think, just speaking for myself, have felt and experienced my entire life. But I had a really innocent childhood, lots of naked running around in mud and, like, you know, very much like this essay. At a certain point, it just changes. And as a woman, you just get so used to it. Like, everywhere you go, like, God forbid if I walk past a group of men and then I have to turn around for some reason, I will watch them all look away immediately because they've all been looking or pointing or talking. And so I find this incredibly satisfying and really beautiful.
That's Cleopatra Coleman. You can see her in Fox's The Last Man on Earth and Showtime's White Famous. I hope you enjoyed this sample of Modern Love, the podcast. And if you did, think about subscribing. And by the way, don't forget the show that brought you this little sample, because Radio Boston has a podcast as well. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.